On Tech News Today, the U.S. Marshals Service gets caught harvesting phone calls from airplanes. Plus, Skype now works in a browser. The U.S. government is building the world's fastest supercomputers, and a new bug has been found in Android Lollipop. It's all coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, November 14th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Now introducing Squarespace 7 with even better site management tools and other improvements. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and Brian Burnett is the person back there with his hand on the volume controls at 11. I love that. That's awesome. Hey, Brian, how's it going? What's at the wide shot? I mean, it's like, never mind. I don't care.
I'm never prepared for that.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you for running the show. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a show. So I appreciate that.
No problem.
And with us today, it's Friday. So it's Christina Warren Day. It's National Christina Warren Day. How you doing, Christina?
I'm good. I like the sound of that National Christina Warren Day.
Yeah. We need to go international eventually, but we'll start local.
We'll start local.
Yeah, and then go global. So, you know, hey, there's a new study that I know you saw. You retweeted something about it, and I know you've seen the study. It tells us why everybody likes Twitter. And, you know, I guess everybody doesn't like Twitter, but the people who do like Twitter like it for very interesting sort of mental reasons. And among those are, number one, emotional arousal, which I guess is better than unemotional arousal. Feelings of personal relevance, which I think is a key one. And of course, memory. So in other words, it's triggering dopamine receptors in the brain, I guess.
Yeah, and I thought it was a really fascinating study, and it basically does, you know, kind of show off. I mean, the reason, you know, one of the big jokes about Twitter for a long time was, you know, oh, who really cares what you're having for lunch or you know, what's happening in your thoughts. But the fact of the matter is that we do, you know, when we're using Twitter, we care about those things. And this study proves it, you know, that we like the fact that it's personalized. We like the fact that it drives, you know, memory as you see something that maybe triggers something else. And we like the fact that, you know, yeah, it comes down to it. It's about us. And I think that I'll certainly cop to having a little bit of narcissism around my Twitter usage. If I look at how many times they say I or me, and I try to curb that, but it becomes a very personal thing. And I think that that's one of the reasons why people who love it and use it so much.
I'd even go further and say that, you know, I tie this into a book by Professor Robin Dunbar called Grooming Gossip and the Evolution of Language. And her thesis basically is that small talk and chit chat is the evolved, essentially language evolved, in order for human groups, you know, I guess in a Paleolithic era or something like that, to maintain social hierarchy and sort of cohesion. And so they could have larger groups. With language, you could have larger groups than you can when sort of like ape species have groups in like, if, you know, do that stuff with other means. And so really all that stuff about here's my sandwich I had for lunch is why we have language. And without language, we wouldn't have the space program and we wouldn't have Android and we wouldn't have the rest. So, hey, you know, don't knock it. I really love the fact that that they're zeroing in on this. This study, of course, was, I guess, paid for by Twitter. And I think that the same goes for Facebook. And I would even go further with Facebook. I think Facebook is genuinely addictive. And I think people, I think they should have like 12-point programs and stuff like that for Facebook.
No, I think that's actually not a bad point. I mean, the internet as itself, it's been around, you know, the web has been around for more than 20 years now. And we've seen 25 years and there have been so many addiction studies, and it is a very real thing. And I think that social media, Facebook especially, but Twitter to a certain degree too, that definitely becomes one of those things where you can very much be kind of taken in by it. And when you are having those dopamine receptors going off, I mean, it makes a very clear clinical case or neurological case, I guess, that yes, these things can have, you know, the addictive component of these things is very real. So it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, if I know I'm addicted. If I could speedball the stuff, I'd do it. Anyway, let's jump into the news here. The U.S. Marshals Service is capturing huge amounts of phone data using devices mounted on airplanes, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. The Marshals Service, which is part of the U.S. Justice Department, runs small Cessna airplanes from at least five city airports and scoops up data from the general public, not just suspects. The so-called dirt boxes, I'm not referring to the people who decided to do this plan, but the actual physical boxes that are mounted on the airplanes, mimic cell phone towers and trick mobile phones into reporting their unique registration information and location. Ian Thompson writes for The Register and joins us from San Francisco to talk about this weird story. Welcome to you, Ian Thompson.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Now, I'm confused. Isn't the Justice Department the people who are supposed to protect us from flagrant violations of the Constitution?
If wishing made it so, yes. I mean, from what we've seen from the story so far, technically it's legal as it stands at the moment based on the information we have. All they're doing at the moment seems to be grabbing the identifying number of a target mobile and dumping everyone else's, or so we're told. And there's no suggestion from the report we've seen they're actually monitoring the content of calls, although it's perfectly possible to do that with available equipment that's available at the moment.
So this is scary. I mean, I don't know if I'm alone in seeing that, but I mean, as you said, it's probably technically legal, but this seems very similar to what Google was doing with sort of their Wi-Fi, you know, hotspotting stuff when the cars, you know, for the Google Maps stuff were driving by and picking up people's, you know, Wi-Fi data that was happening. And they were fined for that. Do you know, is that similar? Is that not similar to kind of what Google was trying to do on the private sector?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's pretty much the same, but because law enforcement does it, therefore it's deemed to be okay. Well, I mean, the argument they're using is that they're just targeting specific individuals. Everyone else's data is just getting thrown away afterwards, which was the argument with Google used. And yes, they faced a fairly hefty fine for doing so. But if the Department of Justice says it's okay, then I guess we just have to suck it up and take it.
The other difference between what Google was doing and what these guys are doing is essentially that when you have a Wi-Fi router in your home, they were essentially hoovering up the data that was on people's personal Wi-Fi. But if you go to Best Buy and you buy a Wi-Fi router and you choose to not lock down the settings and not password protected and not sort of encrypted and all that kind of stuff and just let it broadcast out through your walls, across your lawn, across the sidewalk and across into the street, and a Google car comes driving down that street and your Wi-Fi sort of waves are penetrating that car and going into their thing, you've essentially almost decided to do that. It's like putting a sign in the window with your password, sort of, kind of. In this case, people don't know that their phone calls are being broadcast into the sky where little Cessnas are sucking them up and harvesting that information. That's one big difference. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the FBI's Stingray devices. This is pretty similar to that as well, isn't it?
Yes, Stingray is ground-based as opposed to air-based, and there's a lot more back-end to Stingray in terms of the ability to actually harvest more detailed information from phones. But it's essentially the same technology, and according to documents we've seen this morning, the DEA also has similar technology, which it uses in very similar ways. So this is something that law enforcement's been using for probably the last 7 years that we know about, and they're obviously going to carry on using it and refining it as time goes on.
Now, do we know what cities this is in? You know, they said that it's five city airports. Do we know what cities they're doing this?
We don't at the moment. No, the report said that basically it's five airports, which would be an easy flying time of most of the U.S. So you're probably talking from a geographical spread somewhere like maybe New York, Texas, Chicago, San Francisco.
Atlanta
would be a good one as well, yes. I mean, they did say regional airports as well, which allows them, you know, a certain amount of geographical spread.
And they did say also that the Wall Street Journal report said at least five, so that means, you know, we don't know what it is at most. So it could be 100. So we have no idea, and I'm sure that there's going to be more information coming out about this story. Ian Thompson is at theregister.co.uk and on Twitter at Ian Thompson. Ian spelled I-A-I-N, and then Thompson is spelled like Thompson. Thanks for joining us, Ian.
Thank you.
All right, in just a minute, we're going to tell you about Microsoft's latest product. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace has a new Squarespace 7, which, believe it or not, if you've been a Squarespace user, you know how easy it is to use. Squarespace 7 is even much easier than that. One of the reasons is that it has a new edit on screen feature. So you can just sit there and edit the actual website as you see it. It's, remember WYSIWYG, they used to say it was WYSIWYG and it never really was. Well, this really is, and it makes it really, really easy to build a website. You also get professional stock photography from Getty, an instant branded email set up for Google Apps. So Google Apps users, I know you have a lot of problems with Google Apps in one way or another, but this is one way that it's going to really benefit you, because you can have that custom branded email sent out directly from your website. Best of all, I think they have category-specific templates that cater to the site requirements for industry groups. For example, if you're an artist or a chef or an architect or a musician, they have website templates that are designed just for your area. So this is great news. I mean, think about it. With a chef, you're going to do certain types of things. You're going to put menus. You're going to have pictures of food. And this this template for chefs specifically will make your restaurant or chef-based website look really, really professional right out of the box. And of course, e-commerce is available for all subscription plan levels. So if you want to sell anything or raise money for your nonprofit or whatever, you can do that very easily. Squarespace still starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So start a free 2-week trial now, no credit card required, and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT, and that'll get you 10% off the low price. And to begin using Squarespace 7, of course, existing customers can just go to the Settings tab and activate all the wonderful new toys. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Microsoft is rolling out a beta of Skype that runs in a web browser. That's right, without an app application running on your system. The product runs on Windows Internet Explorer 10 or above, Safari 6 or above, or the newest versions of Chrome and Firefox. Brad Linder is the editor of Lilliputing and joins us now. Hey, Brad.
Hey.
So will this thing require a plugin?
At launch, you're going to need to install a browser plugin, but eventually the goal is to use something called WebRTC for real-time communications, and that's going to allow plugin-free usage. And that means that basically you'll be able to fire up a web browser and just start a voice or video chat or a text chat with colleagues or friends or family members from around the world, basically making it free and easy to communicate with people wherever they are.
So it sounds like this is kind of a competitor to Google Hangouts a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Skype, I think, has earned a reputation because it's been around longer than most of the other similar tools. So people use Apple's FaceTime, they use Google Hangouts, they use all sorts of different tools in order to make free voice video calls over the internet. And I think Skype really, first of all, it was one of the early entries into the space, and then Microsoft bought it and sort of changed the back-end technology a little bit, made it a little bit more robust, uses Microsoft servers instead of just peer-to-peer technology now. And I think one of the reasons that it stayed popular even after there are all these rival services is that it's available across so many different devices. You can use Skype on your phone, you can use Skype on your tablet, you can use Skype on your laptop or desktop, and making it something that you can use in a browser without even having to install anything other than a browser, I think is is a smart move on their part.
Now, based on what you said about the coming implementation of WebRTC, I imagine that this won't work in a Chromebook now, but will once they support WebRTC?
They haven't said so explicitly, and that's sort of an interesting point here, because Chrome supports WebRTC, Firefox supports WebRTC, Opera supports it, Safari does not, and Internet Explorer does not, but will soon. Microsoft's working on WebRTC support. So, so I think there's a question, because right now you can use this if you're selected in the beta. Right now it's not available to the general public. It's available to a small number of testers. You can use it by installing, like I said, a little plugin, and eventually Microsoft promises that you won't need a plugin. But according to the blog post where Skype announced this new service, it very explicitly says Chrome on Windows. So they make it sound like it's not going to work on Chrome if you're using a Mac or if you're using a Chromebook. And that might be a smart play for Microsoft, because right now Microsoft is really positioning low-cost Windows laptops as alternatives to inexpensive Chromebooks. And one of the main reasons I think people still point to Windows as being superior in some ways to Chromebooks is that it runs Photoshop, which isn't exclusive anymore. There is a web-based version of Photoshop, and it runs Skype. And so if there's a web-based version of Skype that doesn't require Windows, you know, I think Microsoft could shoot itself in the foot. At the same time, Microsoft is transitioning, has been transitioning lately from a company that just makes Windows and Office and downloadable software for Windows into a company that really offers web-based and internet-based apps and solutions and services that are cross-platform. And that might be that might be something the company does. Maybe they don't care if you're using Skype on a Chromebook in the future, because that'll be a way that they can get you as Microsoft customers, even if you weren't going to buy Windows.
Brad Linder, so, is it Brett? I'm sorry, you have a question, Christina?
My final question. Sorry, a one pin, Brad. And that's kind of an insight thing. You know, obviously they're talking about this for the desktop mobile browsers right now, but if they do the WebRTC support, my first thought was that this could potentially come to mobile platforms, you know, thinking things like Tizen, but also Firefox OS. Do you get any sense that they might be wanting to do that, especially as you said, to kind of build new customers down the pipe, especially people that might not be, you know, Windows customers at all, you know, if they're living in emerging markets where they might never experience a traditional desktop computer?
Yeah, and Mozilla has really been pushing WebRTC and a number of other technologies that sort of make web applications equal to native applications. And so Firefox OS, as you mentioned, is being positioned initially as a mobile platform for inexpensive smartphones. It doesn't have to be inexpensive smartphones, but they figured that's where the market segment is that they might be able to get in with. So we're seeing these, you know, $100 or cheaper smartphones showing up in emerging markets that are running basically the Firefox web browser and a bunch of apps designed to run on it. So it's possible that if Microsoft makes Skype available with WebRTC, that it'll just automatically run on mobile devices that are running Firefox. It's not 100% clear if that's something that's going to have to come from Microsoft, or once they make the tools available, if it's something that Firefox will have to tweak. But it definitely seems like a possibility.
And I hope that the implementation of WebRTC will somehow improve reliability so that Skype no longer delays the world's greatest technology news show. So just a thought. Brad Linder's at bradlinder.net and also lilliputing.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Brad Linder. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. Department of Energy said today they're going to spend $425 million on two supercomputers for research into basic science and nuclear weapons. I guess it's better than actually detonating nuclear weapons. The new systems are expected to run between 5 and 7 times faster than America's fastest current supercomputers. Stephen Shanklin is a senior writer for CNET News and joins us now from Paris. Welcome to you, Stephen.
Howdy. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. Now, how will these supercomputers compare with the world's fastest, which is currently the Tianhe-2 in China?
Yeah, well, the goal is to push this, several factors faster, a handful of times faster than the Tianhe-2 in China. That's kind of par for the course. You know, a couple years go by, these things get, you know, a factor of 2 faster, a factor of 10 faster. It's pretty remarkable that we take it all for granted. It's actually getting harder and harder to make supercomputers go faster. One of the things I think is actually interesting about this story is not just the $325 million that the DOE is spending on these two IBM supercomputers, but another $100 million on top of that to try to advance supercomputing technology to the next generation. So that's going to be a factor of 20 or 40 times faster than the Tianhe-2.
That's really interesting. So IBM and NVIDIA are involved with this, but what is Mellanox?
Mellanox has been a company that's been around for a long time. Almost nobody's heard of it unless you're the kind of person who builds data centers. They have very fast switching networks. So if you need to connect 1,000 computers to 1,000 other computers, they have a technology that's called InfiniBand. It's a standard, but they're one of the big companies that does it. InfiniBand will handle that. Very big, very fast switches to transfer data from one side of a supercomputer to another side of the supercomputer. So it's basically high speed. It's very high speed networking, faster than Ethernet.
Now, about $325 million of this $425 million is going to be spent on the computers themselves, one called Summit, one called Sierra. The remaining $100 million is going to be spent on something called, quote, extreme scale supercomputing research. Is this an operating system, or what is that exactly?
This is probably mostly going to be hardware, although really the software is important when it comes to making sure the operating system is tuned for it and making sure that you can actually program these things. That's one of the very complicated problems with supercomputers on this scale. You have to break down a problem so that it runs across hundreds of computing nodes. So these are independent servers, each with their own operating system, and they have to communicate. So the software is pretty hard, but I suspect the bulk of this funding is going to go to hardware research. The big problem is that microprocessor clock speeds stopped increasing about a decade ago or so. You get more transistors on them. We get lots more cores, processing cores, but the individual cores don't actually do work faster. So what we have is a problem breaking down computing problems into lots of parallel chunks, and we have a problem with power consumption. So this new research is, I'm sure, going to go mostly toward hardware that will try to increase the speed of computing without increasing the electrical power draw.
That's interesting. Now, Stephen, you wrote a lot. You're very prolific. And if you can stick around for the next story as well, because you've written about that on CNET as well. So let's just jump into that story, which is that a computer science prize called the AM Turing Award has been raised by Google and now totals $1 million, the same amount awarded for Nobel Prizes. The prize used to involve $250,000 funded by Google and Intel since 2007. But after Intel decided to bail on it and stop funding it, Google decided to fund it all and quadruple the prize. Now, Stephen, do we know why Intel dropped out and why Google quadrupled the prize? $250,000 seems like quite a lot of money already.
Well, $250,000 is a lot of money. $1 million is a lot more money. Frankly, I don't think it's necessarily the kind of thing that's going to get a computer researcher to go into the office in the morning. I'm going to have a breakthrough today. This is stuff that gets awarded to very, very prestigious computer researchers a decade after they do, some terrific breakthrough. So I don't think this is the kind of incentive that you'll see for researchers actually just going into the office and coming up with clever ideas. I think this is more about trying to elevate the prestige of computer science, comparable to what the Nobel Prize does for physics and chemistry and medicine and economics and peace. So Google, I think it has Nobel envy. I don't know why Intel dropped out, but I can certainly assure you that Google wants to encourage computer scientists. It wants to increase the prestige of the trade, and it wants its name associated with the best and the brightest in the field. So that's all a way for it to go ahead and accomplish those goals. And let's face it, $1 million a year is nothing for Google.
That's true. So what kind of person normally, gets this sort of prize? I mean, we know the types of people that usually get Nobel Prizes across the various sciences and the various disciplines. But what type of person, usually gets the Turing Award?
You have to be very good. You have to have breakthroughs that are, they can be hardware, they can be software, they can be, algorithm stuff even that's before software. So some of the examples of things that have won the Turing Award include Ethernet, the basic plumbing of the internet, the mouse, we've had some artificial intelligence research, things like hidden Markov chains. And, there's some stuff that's very obscure and hard to understand, but some stuff that is really important to everything that everybody does.
So what you're saying is that Kim Kardashian is unlikely to win this prize for Kim Kardashian Hollywood, as fun of a game as that actually is. Well, too bad. Sorry, Kim. Stephen Shanklin is at news.cnet.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at stshank. Thanks for joining us, Stephen, and staying up late in Paris. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, guys.
All right. FireEye researchers Monday revealed their discovery of an iOS bug called Mask. The security loophole can trick users into downloading malicious apps onto iPhones and iPads. But today, Apple is downplaying the risk. The company told numerous publications that its operating systems are designed to have built-in security safeguards to help protect customers and warn them before installing potentially malicious software, and that users should download apps from trusted sources like, the App Store. The company said they're unaware of actual people being victimized by Mask. Christina Warren, this is really a case where they opened up their sort of app downloading process to enable IT departments and enterprises right. to distribute in the way that they like to distribute, which is sort of en masse. And that's really what created this problem. And like they said, it's theoretical, but I think Apple also said only 9 iPhones or 6 iPhones or whatever it was bent. So
that's true.
I don't think that's a good defense. Do you to say that it hasn't really happened yet?
I don't know if that's a good defense. I do think what's a more valid defense, because, I wrote about this and I looked into this when this came out, and this is something that even before FireEye revealed this was something that Jonathan Zidarensky had revealed too, and a bunch of people have pointed out that there's kind of this potential flaw with the way that Apple's, certificate installation system works and how it works for IT systems. And basically what it means is that, you install an ad hoc profile and you can install apps apps that come from places other than the app store. So you can download a link and install an app. And it'll tell you before you install it, are you sure you want to install this app from whatever the name is and, you know, whatever the company is? And you say yes or no. The problem here is that if you say yes, it not only can install its own app, but it can actually install over an existing app that might already be there. So if you've got an app like Gmail, for instance, it was one of the examples they used, they can use that bundle identifier and install an app that goes over Gmail, can even take any data that might be in that app's bundle file and do things with it. That, I think, potentially could be an exploitable problem, especially with something maybe like Snapchat or WhatsApp if you're trying to get specific types of information. But I do think that the risk is relatively low in the sense that most users, the vast, vast majority, are only going to be installing things from the App Store. And Apple is obviously saying install it from a trusted source like the App Store. Or if you're, you know, doing beta testing, then there's kind of the onus on the user that they know a little bit more about what they're doing. Or if your IT policy is doing something, then that's something that your IT administrator has pushed out. So, I mean, I'm with you that I don't think saying, no, it hasn't been exploited yet, so that doesn't mean it's not a problem. But I also feel like the problem in this case, it's not on the same level as, say, having, you know, apps that have malware that can be installed, you know, across Android. A certain number of levels of checks in place, I think, that make this less likely. But where I could see this becoming more of an issue, and we saw this, you know, last week with some of the stuff with, you know, some of the Mac malware, is users in Asia who are predisposed to using these third-party app stores and are not all about installing things directly from Apple's garden. They could become more at risk for this sort of thing. So,
yeah. So bottom line, pay attention. Don't take any risks. Make sure you're downloading for the right source. That goes even doubly for Android and other platforms as well. So watch out, people. It's unsafe out there if you're not careful. Well, we have some updates for you. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. You got to hire people. You got to hire good people. You don't want to hire people who aren't good, because bad people are hard to get rid of, and good people can make your company or your department or yourself really successful. And in fact, there's no other way to succeed without collaborating with really, really good people. And so the smart way to hire people, of course, is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter lets you post your job to over 50-plus job boards, including social sites, but also the specialty job boards wherever it is where qualified candidates can be found. ZipRecruiter will find them, and then they'll deliver them to you on a silver platter, just the qualified candidates, so you can hire them very, very fast and super easy to review those candidates as well. ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 250,000 happy and successful businesses. And so you got to check this out. You can search over 4 million resumes with thousands of new ones added every single day. So if you checked ZipRecruiter yesterday, check it again today. There's a whole bunch more new ones every single day. So right now, TNT fans can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com. And don't forget the slash and the T and the N and the T. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. The Information is reporting that Samsung Electronics is preparing to spend tens of millions of dollars to invest in short-form mobile video. The project is codenamed Volt, according to the report, and the product may also include music. This is more Google Envy. Samsung sometimes has Google Envy. Usually they have Apple Envy, but this is Google Envy. I assume they want to take on YouTube. Google is killing the Google Wallet API for digital goods on March 2nd of next year. The company will continue to use Google Wallet for apps on Google Play and also in in-app payments, but stop allowing its use on the web in general. Weirdly, Google has no plans to announce the news, as far as we can tell. It was discovered on their website for Google Wallet support, and Google is apparently planning to let users get 404 messages when they encounter a site trying to use Google Wallet. It's all up to the online merchants to learn about the change somehow and remove the client-side integration code. How weird is this, Christina Warren? Why don't they just announce this?
I know. I mean, it's funny, though, because they've kind of done this over the course of a couple of years where they've deprecated the different Google payment options. But yes, I mean, to not even announce this, just basically say, okay, it's up to the merchants who we were still letting use this technology. Now they'll just get 404 pages. Yeah, that's bizarre.
I think they're really touchy about their growing and earned reputation as a company that just kills stuff that people have been relying on. Google Reader being one of the biggest examples, but they just hate that reputation. And it's part of their what they do. They like to fail early. They like tried lots of different things, see what sticks. And that's a, you know, that's a good approach. But the downside is that people get, you know, burned at some point by something they're relying on that ends up being taken offline or being broken or removed or killed or whatever. So kind of a weird thing. Hopefully they'll actually make a bigger deal of it as they get closer to the termination date. Well, BlackBerry is rolling out a new feature of its BlackBerry Messenger service called BBM Meetings. The feature adds voice calls and video conferencing to Android, BB10, Windows PC, and Mac OS. Support is coming soon, according to the company. The main benefit is that it's easy. Instead of dialing in, entering a conference code, and waiting, like we've all done a million times, you can simply answer the phone, and you're in the conference. You can also present from your BlackBerry phone and even share your screen. BBM Meetings can support HD video and 25 participants per call, and the product will be a feature of a new service called the Enterprise Communicator, and it'll cost $12.50 per host per month. The UK internet service providers have agreed to add a reporting tool that will enable their customers to report extremist content they see online, terrorist stuff, that kind of thing. The ISPs include British Telecom, Virgin, Sky, and TalkTalk, and they've also agreed with the UK government to increase web filtering to censor content that may radicalize users. Christina Warren, what do you think about this? This is kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the ISPs themselves are agreeing to commit censorship, yes, and I guess make the decision themselves about what should be censored and what shouldn't.
Yeah, you know, I have to be honest. I understand why they're doing this, and I can appreciate the cause, I guess, but it bothers me. It's bothersome to me that the ISPs are agreeing to work on censoring content and to allow reporting tools to kind of go out. I mean, you worry about potential witch hunts happening, but also about content, you know, just being filtered in general. I guess this is an interesting way. You know, the internet has always kind of been, at least in most countries, I mean, the idea has been that it's been kind of the free-for-all. You could access anything. And the ISPs over there to make the decision to start censoring content and also allowing people to report content from others. You know, I mean, it feels a little Big Brotherish. But I guess I understand the rationale. But I can't help but be bothered by it, I guess.
But that rationale is based on assumptions. It assumes that if you remove people from being able to see horrible content, that they will become less radicalized, and that in general you'll have a better political situation, more peace, and fewer terrorists and stuff. That's an assumption. It could also work the other way. You don't know if people get horrified by seeing this kind of content and decide to take political action in a democracy as voters to make sure that certain groups are shut down or whatever. You don't know what the consequences are going to be for censorship. It could work and come back to bite them in the butt, because, you know, the public could be lulled into a sense of security when there could be all this activity that they're not even seeing because it's being censored. I don't know.
I think that's a great point. I think that you said it absolutely perfectly. It is based on assumptions, and those assumptions, we don't know what the reaction of that would be. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm glad I live in the United States, frankly, is that for all the things that we bandy about with net neutrality, one of the few things that hasn't come up has been, you know, censorship, especially about, you know, political speech. And it's an important part, I think, of what makes the internet the internet. And when we see, I mean, the line gets so fine, right? It's like you have... It's one thing you can say, oh, well, it's fine when you do it about, you know, jihadi and terrorism related speech. But it's not a very far reach to go from that to the sorts of censorship that China enacts on its citizens and then some of the Middle Eastern countries kind of enact. And that's really bothersome that it could become kind of that easy, and that the private sector, and, you know, is being kind of complicit with that along with the government. Is that to me really does kind of bother me, that they're so willing to, you know, kind of kowtow to those sorts of ideals based on, as you said, an assumption that it'll make things better when we really don't have any proof that it will be.
Yeah, give the customers the choice to turn that on or leave it off. But just to blanket ban stuff and censor things doesn't really strike me as a good idea. Now, the blog Phone Arena is reporting a bug affecting users of Google's new Android 5.0, a.k.a. Lollipop. The bug makes it hard for some users of the Nexus 5, 7, and 9 to connect via Wi-Fi. In other news, Volvo is using Google Cardboard as a marketing gimmick. If you recall, Cardboard is Google's open source project for creating cheap virtual reality goggles using cardboard, a rubber band, a magnet, and your smartphone, plus a free app. Now Volvo is offering Cardboard-compatible simulated test drives to promote the Volvo XC90. They'll be distributing Cardboard at the upcoming Los Angeles Auto Show and also at Volvo dealerships. That is a really great idea because it's cheap. You can make these things for about $7.
No, it's awesome. We have a few of them in the office, and a bunch of us have received them, and it's very cool. I think it's actually it's a gimmick, but it's a really great gimmick to kind of show off the car experience and the test drive experience. To me, it's one of those things that, I mean, I don't want to start receiving a million of these cardboard things, you know, to check out apps, but it's a really smart move. And I think it actually kind of does give you the sense of a little bit about what a test drive in a car would be. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I like my one cardboard device, and I'd like a million apps. I mean, that's the thing to do, is have more apps. And the thing that people that I haven't seen a lot of exploitation of, or any exploitation of, is the fact that the hole where a smartphone's camera normally is open on Google Cardboard, according to the open source design, which means that you can use it for augmented reality as well. All the implementations I've seen are virtual reality, where everything you see is on the screen. You can overlay virtual objects onto what the camera sees very easily with Google Cardboard. And I like to see people experimenting with that as well. Well, the world's oceans are being overfished, thanks mainly to illegal fishing that skirts the rules established by international treaties. The problem causes economic losses of about $50 billion a year. Now, Google is working with mapping company SkyTruth and marine advocacy group Oceana to create a tool for tracking illegal fishing worldwide. Their prototype service is called Global Fishing Watch, and it was launched today in Sydney. Actually, yesterday, but it was Friday when they did it. They're hoping the database can help governments crack down on illegal fishing. The technology uses satellite tracking devices that are required for all big boats, and Google algorithms are going to exclude ships that appear to be actually going somewhere as opposed to just sitting there fishing. Unfortunately, it's possible for illegal fishing boats to turn off the tracker. So if this starts to actually affect their ability to illegally fish, they'll probably do that, just turn off the trackers. The program goes public next year or the year after. And finally, a 5-year-old boy named Ayan Qureshi from Coventry, UK, has passed the Microsoft Certified Professional Exam. His dad is an IT consultant, and Ayan has reportedly been into computers since he was 3. And he has his own computer lab, which he built, and it runs a network, which he has also built, but he has big plans. He wants to start a new Silicon Valley in the UK. The hardest part of that, of course, is to find a valley. And also start his own company, and I think that this kid is going places. I've seen him come and I've seen him go, Christina Warren, but this kid's got it.
5 years old, and he's passed. He's a Microsoft Certified Professional. That's amazing. I love that. That's so cool. And yeah, you know, if anybody can, people have been trying to kind of create a valley sort of environment in London for a long time. And if anybody can do it, maybe it's this kid, because that's fantastic. 5 years old.
5 years old.
5 years old.
Man. And we'll keep an eye on this kid and see what he can do by the time.
I was lucky to be able to tie my shoes at 5.
That's exactly.
Like I was super excited about that. I was like, I could set the VCR, but like that was about it. You know, I could.
Super impressive. Super impressive. His dad is an immigrant from Pakistan who arrived in the UK about 5 years ago. So I guess they arrived just before or after the kid was born. And so this is big, big news in Pakistan. They're very proud of this little kid. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Brendan Wood in Canberra, Australia, who says he watches the show on TV via the YouTube app on his Ouya. How do you say that, Christina?
Ouya.
Ouya gaming console. Sort of like the Marine Corps thing. Gaming console while simultaneously working away on his MacBook Pro. And there we are. You look pretty serious in that shot. What's the deal?
I do. I don't know.
You don't like the Ouya?
Deep in thought. No, I like the Ouya. I like the Ouya. Right. There are a ton of those types of devices out there. And it was a big hit on Kickstarter.
Yeah. A lot of people who send in these things are multitasking, doing other work while they got the show running, and that is cool with us. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video, take a picture of your setup or yourself, and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it. That is the Tech News Today. Christina Warren, thanks for being our co-anchor today. What are you working on these days?
Well, so I talked to you last week. I overhyped, and then it got delayed because I was late on my deadline, but my Android versus iOS comparison will finally be going up today. That's basically, really, it'll be a good time since Lollipop is rolling out to the Nexus devices right now. And actually, kind of speaking of the Ouya, I'm doing kind of a big look just in time for the holidays of all the different streaming devices that are out there on the market. You know, we've got the Apple TV, the Fire TV, the Nexus Player, the Roku Stick, the Fire TV Stick, you know, Ouya, Game Stick. There are a million of them. So I'm just kind of going to try to kind of lay it out and kind of in plain English what the cool stuff is, what stuff you can do with them, and which ones you should maybe avoid and which ones you should maybe put on your wish list.
Wonderful. I can't wait to read it. And for the record, I don't think it was overhyped at all. I think you hyped it just right last week. So I'm going to go check it out. I was wondering where it went. I was looking for it all week and I didn't see it. And I thought it was me, but it just wasn't there.
No, it wasn't you. It was just I'm bad at deadlines.
Hey, that's just, we're journalists. What are you going to do?
We are.
Without the deadline, it would never happen at all. So I understand completely.
True.
Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feely, Yahoo, RSS. So many ways to subscribe. Go to twit.tv/TNT and pick your favorite. You're going to follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV, and send us email to tnt@twit.tv. You can call us at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.
Still working on that. Every Friday.